All right, welcome to the Michael Slate Show. I'm your host, Michael Slate. That's right, I'm back. And we have a great show for you today. It's one that really fits in with the climate that's being generated by the rulers in this country today, for this country and all around the world. At the back end of the show, we have a segment that I did, maybe a year ago, almost exactly a year ago, that focused up on the treatment of immigrants in the U.S. And it focused up around how people were rounded up, arrested, children held in jails, deported, families broken up and separated. And my guest for that segment is Margaret Reagan. Margaret wrote a very important book on all this. It's called Detained and Deported: Stories of Immigrant Families Under Fire. And it's a subject that Donald Trump has used as the centerpiece for his whole fascistic agenda. And of course, we should also not forget that Hillary Clinton, his opponent, is not very different when it comes to immigrants. She was, after all, part of the administration that basically has rounded up, jailed, and deported more people than any other administration in the history of this country. And opening things up, we're going to spend some time talking about an incident that happened back a little while ago in July. And it happened in Cleveland, Ohio. Joey Johnson, a supporter of the Revolutionary Communist Party, was in Cleveland demonstrating at the Republican National Convention, and one of the things he did was he burnt an American flag. Now, Joey's the person who burned a flag back in 1984 and who fought through on a case that actually made the Supreme Court declare that it was not illegal to burn a flag. But when he was burning this one in Cleveland, legality wasn't the big question for him. Not going back and saying, see, it's legal, but it was actually saying, look, there's a monster loose in the world, and that monster is the beast that we live inside of and that we continue to feed as we're living here. And he was calling on people to actually recognize what was going on. Him and the Revolution Club, they were calling on people to recognize what was going on in the world and to take a stand around this. And so Joey did set this flag on fire. He was arrested, and 16 others were arrested. And things had developed in a pretty major way. This is a case that actually needs not only your attention, it needs the attention of the people of the world. It needs people to understand what's at stake here, and it needs people to step forward and do something. So joining us to talk about all this is Joey Johnson. Joey, welcome to the show again, man.
Hey, Michael, really good to hear your voice. And that was a beautiful introduction. You framed things well.
Good. Let's jump into it. Why don't you start talking about it? When I said this thing about this isn't just your run-of-the-mill case, there's something much bigger going on here. Why don't we talk about that?
Well, I think that terms are being set for the future. That's what's being fought out in this case. It's not just like you have a protest and some people are arrested and there's work to be done to get people defended on the charges. No, there's a lot concentrated in this case about the future. So myself and the Revolution Club went to Cleveland to oppose the whole Hitlerian, you know, message that was being spewed out of the Republican National Convention. I don't have to tell a lot of your listeners, they're in tune to this, the danger that's concentrated in the whole fascistic message of Trump, of America first and everything, but the ugliness that translates into. We're living in the side of an empire that's done horrific things and continues to do horrific things against people all over the planet. And this message of America first translates into more bombs. There's video now of this and pictures of this hospital in Yemen that was destroyed by the Saudis with all U.S. supplied military hardware, and the children that were just slaughtered or horrifically wounded. This is the real consequences of this USA first. And just to be clear to your listeners, it's not only Trump, it is Hillary. We're talking about criminal choices from a criminal system, either an open fascist or a proven war criminal. That's how I see it. And the need to oppose that, to go up in the face of it, was very sharp. And the Revolution Club went to Cleveland, and for that matter, went to Philly afterwards to make this statement of, we stand with the people of the world. And outside the Republican National Convention in Cleveland, we burned the American flag. It's like we went to the gates of hell. You know, we went right up to the entrance as close as we could get within the protest zones that were carved out and burned the flag to make a statement of internationalism. You know, to, as Bob Avakian, the leader of the Movement for Revolution, says, to say American lives are not more important than other people's lives, that we stand with the people of the world. And that's what we did. And as a consequence of that, our protest was viciously assaulted by the Cleveland police and then several other police agencies that were on location. I mean, literally, there are hundreds and thousands of cops that have been mobilized to intimidate people from coming to Cleveland to begin with. And then those of us that did come, that did brave the storm, so to speak, this was the consequences of it. We were doing what the U.S. Supreme Court had said in my case in 1989 was, is protected political speech, burning the American flag as a form of protest to express contempt for the government, for what this system has done to people. Their own court has said that this was protected speech. And yet what was going on in the streets of Cleveland, once again, right outside of a Republican National Convention, was political repression and suppression of protesters who were daring to make that statement. And now, yeah, I think there's a lot riding on it, a lot concentrated. I mean, think about it. We're living at a moment in history. I'll tell you, I was thinking this the other day watching the Olympics. There's the beautiful athleticism of it that can't escape you. At the same time, there's the way that all of this is wrapped again in so much of America first, and the way people are being trained in chauvinism to think about the world through the lens of like it's only this big island of the USA, and then there's these all these other shall remain nameless countries out there. People are being trained to look at the world through a certain lens, and it is very, very harmful, extremely harmful, because it's just an utter disregard for the lives of the rest of the 7 billion people that live out there on the planet, and just being trained through this chauvinistic lens. So there's that on the one hand. And on the other hand, and just in terms of giving a full picture of the backdrop that our case is occurring on, this summer and for the last 2 years now since Ferguson, there's been intense struggle in this country over the slow genocide, the oppression of black people that's concentrated in what happened in Ferguson with the murder of Michael Brown and all the other ongoing police murders that have occurred since, and the ongoing impunity that the police have been doing this with, where thousands and tens of thousands of people have risen up in protest. And once again, the system is like, we're going to continue doing this with utter disregard for the lives of the people that have been murdered and the heroic and ongoing resistance of people in cities across the country against this. And I've noted that there's actually a number of different places in this city where people are in the country where people have stood on the flag or stomped on the flag or burned the flag, especially in outrage over this oppression of black people that's concentrated in the murders by the police. So this is all part of kind of the larger swirl in society, the swirl of events where these contending messages and views of the flag and of what kind of a society that we live in and what kind of future we're going to have. I think that myself and the Revolution Club were walking point for a view that the system is hideous in what it does to people here and people all over the world. It is a symbol of oppression and plunder and murder. And that's what the system is retaliating against and attempting to punish and suppress. And now people are facing really punitive, not just the initial arrest. The charges should have been dropped. It's just outrageous what they did to us. They moved to suppress this. They moved to crush it. We had set up a safety circle where the flag could be safely burned and no one injured around us, you know, from shards of the flag, the burning flag or what have you. We were very conscientious about that. And the police rushed and crushed through that circle to suppress it with a fire extinguisher and assaulting people and hauling people out, myself in a chokehold and viciously attacking and brutalizing other people and now charging us. And then beyond that, they've upped the ante. They've gone to a grand jury and have brought felony charges against two of the defendants. One of them has three felonies, from felony assault on the police to felony obstruction of justice, and is facing more than 4 years in prison. And this is, I want people to know, this is the same grand jury in Cleveland, Ohio, that couldn't bring themselves to filing charges against the police. After months and months and months, the police that had brutally murdered Tamir Rice, the young 12-year-old child who had a toy gun and was on a plane on a playground, and police rushed, rolled up, and within 2 seconds had murdered him, had filled his body with shot, a child with a toy. And they could not bring themselves, the same grand jury, to indict these cops for taking this 12-year-old black child's life. But they could bring themselves to bringing additional charges against these brave resistors from the Revolution Club. So people have to find out about this and have the backs of the RNC 16, as we've come to call ourselves, to free Gregory, Joey Johnson, myself, and the RNC 16 to demand that these charges be dropped. You know, whether you would yourself would go out and do this or burn a flag, do you want an atmosphere where resistance is silenced? Do you want an atmosphere of forced patriotism, of compulsory patriotism, where people are intimidated to express opposition to the empire and the things it's doing around the world or the things that it's doing right here? Or do you want to stand up against us? And this is what we need people to join us in and to go to revcom.us and to find out about and to be part of this fight. There's so much at stake for the future. I'm here in Cleveland right now, and it's exciting to be here. There's more than 30 attorneys that have stepped forward, because you think about it, these attorneys in their daily law practices, so many of them are involved in fighting against the whole slow genocide, the mass incarceration and police terror, just in the kind of cases they take on in their daily law practices. And I think that this case has really struck a chord with them, and they want to take it on. They want to fight it for a range of different reasons. But it's been inspiring and an honor to meet them and to begin to work together with them to mount the battle in the legal arena. But we also got to be fighting this case out here in society as a whole, in terms of everything it concentrates and what it portends for the future. And so that's what I want to say to your listeners. And I want to send a shout out to all the listeners of your show. And they should go to revcom.us to find out more information and this battle that we're engaged in. And there's so many needs. Right now there's a statement that's been issued demanding that our charges be dropped, to drop the charges on flag burner Gregory Joey Johnson and the RNC 16. People can find that revcom at revcom.us. Go there and support it. The statement is powerful, and it's already been signed by many prominent voices, including Noam Chomsky has signed it, and Cornel West has signed it. Carl Dix from the Revolutionary Communist Party has signed it. Yusuf Salam, this is beautiful to me. Yusuf Salam, if people remember, one of the Central Park Five who Trump made the ugly comment about when the Central Park Five were framed for the rape of a jogger in Central Park, and Donald Trump made the comment about that they should receive the death penalty in New York it's just painful to talk about. There's a movie people can see, a documentary called The Central Park Five. So Yusuf Salam is behind us, the uncle of Oscar Grant. Cephas Johnson, Uncle Bobby, has signed a statement demanding our charges be dropped, and many other prominent lawyers and civil rights and civil liberties attorneys. And the listeners to your show need to go to revcom.us and find that statement and join us in fighting this in the legal arena and in the societal arena. These questions, I've learned that, have to be fought out in society. It's not just that you fight in the courtroom, but people have to fight this out in society. It has to be a demand. This just concentrates so much about what kind of society and what kind of world do we want to live in.
You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Joey Johnson. Joey is a supporter of the Revolutionary Communist Party, and he is also the person that burnt an American flag at the Republican National Convention in Cleveland, Ohio this past summer. Joey and 16 others were arrested off of that, and Joey and a couple of other people are now facing some fairly serious charges. Let me ask you this, Joey, and it fits in with what you're talking about, because I think, again, it's really important, all the things that you've been saying, and particularly in terms of the stakes that are involved here. And when you look at, like, what's happening around the world, what's happening in this country, what's happening to the environment, all of these kinds of things. And one of the things that really struck me in terms of getting a handle on actually being able to see the stakes is part of the way is the whole way that this is being approached. These are some outlandish, just like, tricks and deceptions and all these things that are going on, from the accusing you of actually assaulting two reporters to keeping people out of the courtroom in the first day, trying to tie them up so they won't be able to go back out into the street, all kinds of things. And then these charges that you mentioned, you talked about this being punitive. And I want people to understand that this is really, it's punitive, and it's a warning to anybody else who might be considering the things that you were talking about, the people that are already doing this, that are following the example set and exhibiting the kind of hatred and disgust with the monster that this country is and what it does to people here and around the world. And yet, there's this thing of like pushing it and pushing it and pushing it so that people will understand that if you do step out, they're going to hit you. And that's the big message they're making, is that this is punitive and it's meant to be preventive in terms of other people following your example. Because I got to tell you, man, I think people all over the world, when that flag was burnt, I think people all over the world gave a cheer. I was thinking about just the other day, I was thinking about what must immigrants think who are fighting their way across this country in a wholesale barrage of lies and filth that's being told about immigrants and what happens to them when they get here and if they get caught and all this other stuff and then the life they lead here. All of these things, all the stuff that's happening. And here, this burning of the flag saying this country has never been great and it's always been a source of oppression and repression for the masses of people in the world as well as in this country. But I wanted the people to get a sense of there's been some shenanigans and some sort of chicanery going on in terms of how they're actually mounting this case. And I thought that would be important for people to know, just a few examples of that.
Yeah, I so appreciate what you're saying. I mean, two things. One is, yeah, there is a lot concentrated because here we have a situation where we came here from all over the country. We came together. We make a powerful statement. As we said at the time, we're doing this for the people of the world, to stand with the people of the world. And I know it resonated with people all over the planet. There was that sense. And it was in the face of a lot of intimidation. I mean, they bragged before the Republican National Convention that about everything that they had put in place, thousands and thousands of police, Homeland Security, Secret Service. They had state troopers from Ohio, from Indiana, we're still learning like what they had assembled here. And it created a whole atmosphere and intimidation of basically stay away or face the wrath of this. And if you think about it, in the months before the RNC in Cleveland, people around the country, everywhere Donald Trump came, there had been opposition and people coming out into the streets or going to his rallies to denounce him. And that was very important. And yet coming into the RNC, they were responding to that and trying to create this whole atmosphere of intimidation. And I have to say, a lot of people stayed away. They should have been here in the streets. And we have to understand that more deeply. But it made it all the more important, the hundreds of people who did come to Cleveland to protest. And I want to send out a shout out to Tom Morello and the Prophets of Rage, because they came here and they organized a whole concert against the RNC and a march after the concert to the gates of the RNC, which was a beautiful thing and part of creating a whole culture of resistance. That was important. But still, what happened was to try to create an atmosphere of intimidation. So the hundreds of people that did come into the streets of Dallas, listen to me, going back to 1984 when Ronald Reagan was being renominated, when he burned the flag outside the Republican National Convention there. No, this is Cleveland, 2016. And those of us that came here to make our statement to the world, it's extremely important. But yeah, now in terms of how they're retaliating against it, what has happened is that my charges in particular, I think they're in a tight spot. I'm talking about the prosecution and the state, because how to charge me is complicated for them, because they can't call it an arson, because it was a burning of an American flag, like a burning of an effigy. It's to make a political statement. It's the furthest thing from an arson. So here they came with this charge of claiming that I assaulted two reporters. And who are the two reporters? They're two InfoWars. InfoWars is a right-wing conspiratorialist, fascist, Trump supporters. And these people call themselves reporters, but they make a video statement after the protests where they brag about having hated what I was doing with burning the flag and how they were rushing and saying on video that they assaulted me, that they punched at me, that they kicked at me, that they tore my shirt, bragging about this on video after the fact. And these are the two people that I'm charged with assaulting, according to the prosecution, according to the state. My charge is a misdemeanor assault on these two reporters. So this is outrageous and almost like laughable, but it's very serious, because this is part of the criminal case going forward against myself and the RNC 16. And then, as I mentioned earlier, you have two of the defendants that are facing felony assault charges. The police assaulted them, then, of course, charged them with assault. And then you have we talk about being punitive. is all of our defendants, the Orange 16, were scattered across the country. I mean, people came together. The Revolution Club came together from around the country to protest at the RNC and then at the DNC in Philly. But now everyone that was arrested here in Cleveland is being forced to repeatedly come back to court dates. So we're talking about what's going to become thousands and potentially tens of thousands of dollars in airfare for repeated court appearances where there's nothing happening except pre-trial discussions or how to go forward with the case. But there are things that the defendants could work through with their attorneys over the phone. They don't have to be here every court appearance. So it's straight up punitive and vengeful for our daring to have protests outside the RNC to begin with. So there's a lot of needs around this case that, again, I encourage your listeners to go to revcom.us to find out more of the facts about it, to find out how there's a fight concentrated over the future and is resistance going to be silenced versus defended, and other needs that your listeners to your show can help fulfill. So, you know, I encourage people to do that, to be part of standing with us and to demand that the charges be dropped. And look at this statement that's coming from people from very diverse backgrounds, but think that our charges should be dropped and that what we did should be, there should be a space for it in society and that they want to defend this.
Mm-hmm. And people should really deeply consider, and this is the last thing I'll ask you to comment on again because I think it's worth repeating, this point about people should deeply consider the polarization here, the difference between what was concentrated in your burning of the flag and what's concentrated in not just Trump and Clinton and all the love America and the war and all this other stuff and the glory of America. But even looking at, again, looking at the Olympics, like you said earlier, where you can see this beautiful athleticism going on at the same time, you have the just overwhelming celebration of American chauvinism, even to the point where that one of the young gymnasts who didn't have her hand on the heart as they were doing that was pilloried all over throughout the country for being, what is she doing? Is it some foreign protest that shouldn't be allowed? You know, this young black woman who just didn't, for whatever reason, didn't put her hand on her heart. But everything gets called into that focus where it's love America, America the great, or we're going after you. Let's talk about that as the end of this.
I mean, I couldn't agree more. I mean, that's why I was talking about it earlier, because it struck me. It struck me so powerfully when I was watching the Olympics. And if you pull the lens back and you think about this, so there is a larger societal swirl, you know, that's going on. And a world that these things have real world consequences in terms of people being trained in this narrow-mindedness or to look at the world through such a narrow lens. And I really want to challenge your listeners because, as we said in Cleveland and in Philadelphia, this whole Trump versus Clinton is a criminal choices of a criminal system. And I know a lot of your audience is clear on that around Trump, but then this ways people rationalize Clinton, you know, and I really think people have to think about how Clinton is not someone who is a bystander or spectator to what her husband did when Bill Clinton was in office. She was not an ornamental first lady. No, she was in the mix. She was in the thick of it. I mean, give her due. People have amnesia. I'd say it's the United States of atrocities and the United States of amnesia because it do these horrible crimes. It does these horrible crimes against people around the world. And then people are supposed to have selective amnesia and forget about them. But upwards of 500,000 people in Iraq perished from the sanctions that went on under Clinton's regime. And this was the sanctions of denying medicine or interfering with people in Iraq having clean drinking waters. And so all these people, these are the consequences of these strangling sanctions that U.S. imperialism puts on regimes that aren't cooperative with it and completely are submissive to it. Aside from the wars, the repeated wars the U.S. has waged in Iraq or against Iraq as all part of the dynamic of oil, power, and empire, and the horrific damage that they've done to a whole arc of countries from Pakistan to Tunisia, from Somalia to Syria. The U.S. is 1,000 times worse than ISIS. You know, it's responsible for something horrific like ISIS coming into existence. So Hillary has been part of that, and Hillary has been part of the whole mass incarceration and police terror. She did say that black youth were super predators that needed to be brought to heel. And you're supposed to have amnesia about it and think that, oh, it's, you know, it's not that bad. You know, after the fascism of Trump and stuff, you know, that she's reasonable. No, let's look reality in the face. This is the future, and she'll be doing horrible things, you know, if she becomes commander-in-chief to the people of the world, because essentially it's not the personality. No, it's a system of imperialism, and it's imperatives and requirements that's driving all of this. So I think people have to face up to that. That regardless if we agree on all that, people have to defend. When people do rise up against us, when people do make a powerful statement of internationalism, even if it's not something you would do yourself, do you want there to be a space for this? And do you want to defend this when it happens? And that's the challenge before all of your listeners and people in society as a whole. And we do intend to wage a societal battle around these cases, just like we did back in 1984 and 1989 around my Supreme Court case, Texas versus Johnson. And that was key to winning then. And I think it winning both in the political sense in terms of setting terms in society as a whole and creating the most favorable terms to fight it out in the courtroom. So I hope all of your listeners will be part of this and will help spread the word and will help create the best terms for fighting this out in society as a whole.
All right, Joey, thank you very much for joining us today, man.
Thank you, Michael. All right. Good to talk to you.
You too, man. And we'll stay in touch to follow this out. All right. All right.
Great.
All right. Take care, man. You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we've just been talking with Joey Johnson. He's part of 16 people, 17 actually. There's a reporter who has also been included up in all this, and they're part of the people who were busted for burning a flag at the Republican National Convention. They later burnt one again at Philadelphia at the Democratic Party's convention, and they were busted in Cleveland, and the authorities are going over the top in terms of the kind of repressive measures they're taking and the ways they're trying to force people into jail, people facing years in jail, and they're doing it because why? Because there's a whole hell of a lot of stake in the kind of world that they're trying to build, the kind of monstrosity that they're trying to bring into power, and anything that stands up as powerfully as that action did and said, the hell with that, and says it in a way that not only informs and inspires people here, but all over the world, sisters and brothers, all over the world, people looking at that and saying, yes, there is a force. There is a force inside that beast that actually understands that America is not great and that the whole world comes for us, that American lives are no more important than any other lives in the rest of the world. We're going to take a quick musical break and be right back, so stay tuned.
Midnight near the border, trying to cross the Rio Grande. Running with coyotes, the winter streets are paved with gold. You're diving underwater when you hear the helicopter. Knowing it's all been best and worthless if you run into patrols. Hiding in the shadows, so and that you won't scream, but you dare not make a sound if you want to hold on to your dream.
Hold on, you may not be a lot, but you hold on, cause you know it's all you got.
No matter the consequences or the fear that grips your senses,
you have got to hold on to your dream.
City of the angels, its bright light fascination only adds to the confusion that your mind must now endure. The gringos take advantage when they know that you're illegal, but you avoid la policia like a plague that can't be cured. Paying the mordida, you find out just what oil means. You cannot file complaints if you want to hold on to your dream. The consequences or the fear that grips your senses, you have got to hold on to your dream. Down at the Western Union, sending cash back to your family, or drinking down cerveza, the weather lights are very low. Your mind may start to wander when you think about your village or the woman that you love so much who's still in Mexico. Just $2 an hour, there ain't little to redeem. This life accepted in your mind, you're trying to hold on to your dream.
Hold on.
Welcome back. That was Gil Scott-Heron with Alien, Hold On To Your Dreams from his album 1980. Very moving, very soul-stirring, and very, very important for what's going on in the world today. All right, I'm going to be pretty quick on this one. This is a rerun of an interview I did with the author Margaret Reagan. Listening to all the reactionary poison that's being spewed during this election season around immigrants, and especially from Donald Trump around immigrants, and how he's going to build a giant wall to keep everybody out, and he's going to arrest and send people back and all this stuff, and he's actually unleashing a whole fascistic atmosphere around the question of immigration. I thought it would be really important to listen to this interview with Margaret Reagan, who's the author of a book called Detained and Deported: Stories of Immigrant Families Under Fire, and it tells a very, very moving story of just what is the situation with immigrant people today.
I'm really pleased to be welcoming to the show my next guest, and this is Margaret Reagan. And Margaret wrote a book that somebody actually pulled my shirt tail on it. They said, look, check this book out. You've got to. I'm starting to read it. It's just knocking me back in my seat. And I picked the book up and I started reading it, and quite literally I read it and I spent an entire day reading it. And I just didn't want to stop. And I went from beginning to end and was extremely moved by this book. And it's the story of immigrants in the U.S. and in the entire North and Central America. You know, what's happening there? What's the story? And it's actually, I felt, and we'll talk with Margaret about this in a minute, but I felt that this was really a story that in this book, the thing that really, really holds on to you is that it's a constant struggle between the dehumanization of all these human beings that are forced to leave their home, to leave everything they know by the conditions there, and come to a place they know nothing about and desperately seeking to survive, or once they've been there, to stay here, versus what actually is the system that's actually bent on and constantly finding new ways to dehumanize all these people. And that was a theme that I think really, really, you know, winds through this entire book and in very creative and very moving ways. So, Margaret, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you so much for having me, Michael. That was a wonderful introduction. I appreciate it.
Good. It was a wonderful book, sister. Really wonderful. I meant it clearly. I couldn't stop. I couldn't put it down until I finished it.
Wow.
So, it was, yeah.
Great.
Let's tell people exactly what the book is about.
Okay. Well, it kind of comes out of a previous work. I wrote a book 5 years ago about the deaths of immigrants in the Arizona desert, which is a huge issue here in, I live in Tucson, and I'm a reporter here in town, and so I started writing about these deaths long about 2000, and a book came out in 2010 called The Death of Joceline about how many people are dying. They're still dying out there. We're up to close to 3,000 bodies found in the last 15 years, which is a lot of bodies, and just in an American state, right, to find these bodies lying around on public lands often. But after that, you know, I learned some things when I was reporting on that book. I started learning about the detention centers, and I started meeting migrants on the border who, they were not first-time crossers. These were people who had lived in the United States for a long time and had families here and had been deported. And they're stuck across the other side of the border trying to get back home. So I decided to investigate this whole issue of people who did successfully cross the borders many years ago, have lived these very American lives, often have American citizen children, and then something happens, you know, some small event, they're driving with their taillight out or something on that level often, and they get caught. Their lives are upended. They're sent to these detention centers, which have appalling conditions. And eventually, many of them are deported, and many, many of them are separated from their children. So it's a huge and ongoing issue. It's kind of like this is the immigration story now, the fact that so many people are living here, and this crisis is affecting them every day. And as you said, they live in fear, the ones who haven't been caught, that, you know, one day maybe their light will go out on the back of their car.
Yeah, you know, and it's very heavy, because when you lay this out in terms of the scope and the situation that people are facing, I mean, I am someone who has paid attention to this. At the same time, when I looked at the actual numbers and the scope, the breadth of this, I was stunned. And I want to,
really?
Yeah, can you tell people, like, I want people to get a sense of, like, We're talking about so many millions of people. And when you're, and you divide your book up into detention and deportation, and when you add all of those figures together, this, and even with the taking into account the overlap, we're looking at a story of millions of people per year who are caught up in this and being eaten by this machinery.
Right. Well, typically in a single year, we have about 400,000 people cycling through the detention centers. Not all being held at one time. We usually have about 35,000 being held on a given day. But over the course of a year, 400,000 people being brought there. And approximately, you know, equivalent to that, about 400,000 being deported and what they call it formal removal every year. So, yeah, close to 1 million people affected in some way every single year. And then, you know, the numbers add up as you go on. I think Obama is up to, and, you know, he's been in office for what now, 7 years almost. You know, his numbers are up to about 2 million deported. And, you know, that's been true with the previous presidents also.
You know, there's something, Margaret, that is really was I was going to say this to the end, but I really want people to get this. The way you open up your book, I think it captures exactly what you're saying. You have this position. I mean, these are people, again, these are people who are just, they're looking for a way to stay alive. And it's like everything has been so screwed up, mainly by the workings of the economies of this society and what goes on with all this. And there's no work, NAFTA destroying all this stuff, in Mexico and, people just not being able to live in the ways that they did. And you present something in the beginning of the book that I found to be, again, sort of sucked me in right away. You presented this when I was talking about the constant tension between the humanity of the people and the constant assault on that humanity through the system and the people that defend or the enforcers of the system. You start with a beautiful portrait of what goes on at that wall. Can you just give people a sense of your take on that? It was a very poetic sense of that.
The wall.
Yeah, it's important.
Yeah, we're so used to this wall down here in Arizona. Yeah, it's this amazing thing. Every day you see lines of people being marched back over the border into Nogales. And then one of the most poignant things is, you know, a few years ago, they built a great big new, stronger wall. They had a fairly flimsy thing. It was, and this is a poetic metaphor also, the original wall was made out of helicopter landing flats that had been used in the Persian Gulf War and in Vietnam. It was army surplus, but they were just these sort of junky-looking metal things. And 2011, the government decided to build these really thick, tall posts. These walls now go up about 20, 25 feet, but they wanted the wall to be see-through, so they have 6 inches in between these posts. You can't get through it. But the Border Patrol wanted to be able to see who was on the other side, if somebody was planning to try to climb over. It just gives them more information if they can see what's going on in Mexico. But one of the side effects of this has been that families meet between the wall. I witnessed, you know, a father on the American side. You know, he's in America. He goes down there to visit his wife and children. Little boy handing his school paper through the bars to his father. It's very heartbreaking. That wall is an improvement for families like that. But there's also a downside. We do have a case in which a Border Patrol agent stuck his gun through that see-through wall and shot a 16-year-old boy on the Mexican side. And that happened more than 3 years ago now. And right now there's a case going on. His mother has sued the federal government. They argue that because this did not take place in the United States, the death of the boy didn't take place in the United States, they don't have jurisdiction and nobody can be prosecuted. So the mother is challenging that in court right now. So.
It's interesting, too, though, because when you think about that, all the people, they just came out with some kind of decision. I can't remember who made it, whether it was the Border Patrol or the government, some branch of the U.S. government, that there's been so many shootings along the border.
Yeah.
No one's held responsible. It's all like, well, we can't prosecute anybody. You know, sorry, it was all in the line of duty, you know, which is like.
I know. Oof. If you think about it, if it were reversed, if a Mexican law enforcement officer aimed his gun through there and shot a 16-year-old kid in Arizona, you know, it would be a big international incident.
Mm-hmm.
But it's amazing. Yeah, the Border Patrol is kind of notorious. You know, it's kind of parallel. We're learning a lot about the police in American cities right now with all these cases that we've been hearing of police fatal shootings of people on the streets. The Border Patrol has an amazing record of killings that they're always exonerated. Invariably, they're exonerated, and very few of them really get investigated to any level.
Mm-hmm. Well, we're going to talk about that in a minute. I wanted to also, though, go into this detention centers that you talk about, in which, to me, you know, look, I considered myself, okay, I know enough about this, or I know quite a bit
right.
about it, but not, and as your book pointed out, not nearly enough, because these detention centers, while I knew they existed, the scope, the magnitude of the repression that goes on inside the centers, but the scope of the centers themselves, the fact that they are all over the place, and then with this concentration in Arizona, which, you know, okay,
right, yeah.
What are we going to do about Arizona, huh?
Yeah, I know. Yeah, somebody wrote a book, The Trouble with Kansas. I guess we need another one, The Trouble with Arizona.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, I mean, I was the same way when I started hearing about this. There are about 250 different detention centers around the United States. And one of the things that's the most astonishing about it is that we, the people of the United States, don't really operate them. Many, many, many of them are run by private prison companies under contract to the U.S. government. Partly because, you know, this whole industry grew so quickly, you know, the government can't possibly afford to build its own. But these ones run by the private prison companies, that's Corrections Corporation of America and the GEO Group, they're in the prison business. They're used to dealing with criminals, convicted criminals, felons, and so on in their private prisons. And that's their model. And these detention centers are not supposed to be punitive prisons. They are supposed to be civil detention, meaning people are not being held for a criminal punishment, but they're being held simply to assure that they will appear at their deportation hearings. But the people inside are treated exactly like prisoners. I visited the great big one in Arizona called Eloy Detention Center, which is the only one in Arizona that houses women. And I went there on a visiting day to visit this woman. I couldn't believe, I mean, I'm not familiar with criminal prisons either. So I went in there and I was shocked at the way that they treated the families. They sort of crowded them into this great big lobby. People had to wait for hours to visit their loved ones. The guards were yelling at the little kids. You know, one little boy was bored to tears. You know, he was playing on a gate, and this guard just yelled at him. I never saw anything like, oh, honey, are you here to visit your daddy today? You know, like most of us normally talk to little children like that in public. The whole thing was very, very harsh. And at this private prison, they also limit the family visits to very few hours. And by contrast, ICE, you know, Immigration and Customs Enforcement, has its own detention center a couple miles away in another town called Florence. And that place is run a lot better with family visits 7 days a week, all day long. The food is better. But we only run about something like 11 ourselves. Everything else is contracted out. And as we've been learning about the detention centers in Texas, they're poorly monitored. You know, that these companies are not necessarily complying with the regulations that they agree to when they get the contract.
Let me take a real quick break here and let people know that you're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Margaret Regan. She's the author of a great book called Detained and Deported, Stories of Immigrant Families Under Fire. The thing that got me, too, is like the point you were just making about these are civil prisons, and people are not, these people who are in these detention centers, a lot of them have already done jail time. They're not supposed to be doing any more jail time, or people, a lot of the people who are in there weren't meant to do jail time, but the idea, as you're saying, that this has suddenly become, these are actually prisons. And one of the things that was really shocking, I think, to me, because I know something about solitary confinement and the impact it has on people, there's a regular standard of solitary confinement for people who break the rules or who are being unruly. You know, this is disgusting.
I know, it's very shocking. You know,
yeah.
We condemn the use of solitary confinement. Remember those three hikers that wandered over into Iran a few years ago?
Mm-hmm.
Americans, and they were held in solitary. And the woman, I don't remember her name, who was one of them, when she got out of there, finally, she came back and wrote how debilitating it is and went on to make the very important point that, yes, we practice solitary confinement in our prisons in the United States. And shockingly, in these immigration detention centers. One of the women in my book that I interviewed, she was 61 years old, skewing pretty much older than, you know, the usual population there. And she told me she had these terrible anxiety attacks. She was a good, living, Catholic, you know, religious woman, worked hard all her life. It was so disturbing for her to be locked up in this tiny cell. She started having all these panic attacks and hive attacks. She kept going to the nurse at the Eloy Detention Center, and the nurse got angry at her for coming. And she said, if you come in here one more time, you will be placed in solitary. And that's as punishment for seeking medical care. Mm. And that woman finally said, just deport me. I cannot stand it anymore. And that's, you know, the criticism of these centers is that we allow them to be so harsh because that's what our goal secretly is. We don't want them to make use of the rights that we've afforded them to fight their case. We just want them out of here, and a lot of people just can't stand it. So they, you know, in a way, they self-deport.
Mm-hmm. It's heavy, too, because, you know, you talked about Eloy, and then there's this other one that, and you know, which is sort of the garbage pail of the entire system, it seems, the one that was connected up.
Pinal County Jail.
Yes.
That one was horrible, yeah.
Yeah.
That had been named one of the 10 worst, and even in the course of writing my book, I wrote all this stuff about it, and then all of a sudden ICE pulled their contract. It was so bad that even ICE couldn't tolerate it.
Yeah. You know, but what I was going to say is that in all these conditions, there's actually something that also I think people don't think about very much, and that is suicides and the suicides that are on the rise within these detention centers.
Right, yeah. Well, while I was writing this book, two young Guatemalans committed suicide in the Eloy Detention Center a few days apart. They both committed suicide, and neither one had even been there for very long. One was a young woman, one was a young man. And, you know, it came out that Eloy was not even abiding by the suicide prevention protocols that were set in place in their contract. And even more shocking, when ICE discovered that they weren't, the ICE statement was, we are negotiating with Corrections Corporation of America to bring their standards up to meet the legally required standard. And I'm thinking, negotiating? We're paying these people to do this job. The very least is we could insist that they abide by the conditions and the regulations. So, I mean, they did make changes after that. But, you know, there are a lot of people in despair up there. In Eloy, there are very many Guatemalan women who are seeking asylum, and they can be held for years. One woman I interviewed, when I haven't checked on her in a while, but she'd been there about 3 years, because they can keep appealing their cases. And, you know, this is what we've been hearing about these mothers and children in Texas. They're applying for asylum. They're applying for asylum as refugees, and yet we're housing them in these, you know, really appalling conditions when they're just asking under international law for asylum for their fear, you know, their fear of being in their home country.
Mm-hmm. You know, one of the things that the other part of your book, the other half of your book is on deportation. And one of the things that you bring out there that was really, I mean, it's just so moving in terms of how, again, people's lives. It's one thing you're picked up, you're shut down into these detention centers, you're separated off from everything. And many times the end result is being deported. And even after spending 6 years fighting to try and have some semblance of, okay, I can stay here, whatever. But the deportations and the brutal inhumanity that's unleashed with these deportations, I wanted to ask you very quickly about one person in particular that really stuck with me. I think her name is Elena Santiago.
Right. Uh-huh.
Very moving story, because I think it captures a lot of what happens to so many people.
Yeah. I mean, her story, you know, and she's still down there. She was a single mom with a teenager and a little toddler girl, and she was arrested by ICE at her house one morning. The kids were taken away from her and put in foster care with Child Protective Services because she had no family that they could go to. And she was deported within something like 24 hours of being picked up. She landed in Nogales, Sonora, which is the town right across from Nogales, Arizona, where they drop them off. She didn't have any identification with her, which proved to be a huge problem for her as time went on. She had no money. She had no extra clothes. She had nothing. She hadn't been in Mexico in 27 years, and here she lands in this town, which, you know, is kind of dangerous for a woman just hanging around on the streets. No idea what to do, where to go, no way to get in touch with her children. And her case, the only reason I know about her, I mean, there are many people like her that I don't know about who don't get help. An activist group located her, she found them, and they helped her get in touch with Child Protective Services and get on the phone, and she was able to speak to the children in foster care. But get this, she's in Nogales trying to rebuild her life, and the state of Arizona moves to sever her parental rights to the little girl, who was 2 or 3 at that point, because she was not an available mother. Because she was a detainee, I mean a deportee, she was not there to take care of her child. Therefore, she was an unfit mother. And the state moved to sever her parental rights to that little girl. The teenage boy was on his own. He can make the decision not to be adopted. But so she had to fight to maintain her parental rights to that child. So ultimately, she was able to get her back. But I witnessed the whole trial around this. It was on the phone. She wasn't allowed to attend the case, the hearing in Phoenix, because she's a deportee. So she's down there in Nogales on the phone, for Pete's sakes, and they're talking about whether or not they're going to remove her child from her permanently. And she was also not allowed to speak. She was only allowed to listen. And surprisingly, they did bring her the child back down there in Mexico. But she's really struggling down there. You know, she has this kid who's traumatized. They'd been apart for 14 months, and when they got back together, they didn't even speak the same language. The child no longer spoke Spanish. And the child is very disrupted. She became very attached to her foster mother. And she had a nicer place to live up in Phoenix. You know, now she's with a mother who's just scraping by in this kind of difficult Mexican city. So, yeah, it's a shocking thing how people are just dumped over there and they don't have any idea what to do.
You know, there's one thing, we have time for one last question for a few minutes, and I'll be quick with the question. You can, you know, do your answer. But the thing is the response. I think actually, you know, one of the things that really struck me too about another section of your book, which is called Resistance, and I felt that was so important and so inspiring, because similar to the situation where you have black and brown people being gunned down, wantonly gunned down all over the country in just unbelievable numbers, and by the police and various other enforcers of authority here. But you also have, in this situation, you have people saying, we will not tolerate this any longer. And I was very inspired, particularly I thought that the streamline example you gave was actually so good.
Wasn't
that amazing? Oh, it was great. It said, I'm sitting there going, yes, this is what we need more of on every front. We need more of this. You know? But give people just a sense of that. And then,
yeah. Okay. Well, this is another interesting thing about immigration policy, that they randomly select about 70 border crossers every day to prosecute, with the idea that if people hear on the other side that maybe they're going to end up in jail for crossing, usually they just get sent back, the early border crossers. So every day they randomly arrest 70 people, put them in the Border Patrol jail for a couple days, and then they have these mass hearings before a federal judge. You've never seen anything like it in the United States. 70 people at once being tried. They come into the courtroom in chains and, you know, handcuffed and chains around their feet. And they shuffle in, you know, it's like some, I don't know, it's like something out of the 18th century, seeing prisoners shuffled in like that. And they're all dirty and smelly from being in the desert. And they all plead guilty. They have a chance to meet with an attorney for 10 minutes a day. And they all plead guilty because, as one attorney said to me, it's all set up that way. If they plead not guilty, then they're going to be in prison for a lot longer because they're held there without bail until they can have a regular trial. So if they plead guilty, then they'll maybe be sent to jail for 3 months or 6 months, and then they'll get out. So they all plead guilty. They all say one by one, culpable, culpable. And then, you know, they're all convicted. So it's like a foregone conclusion every day, 70 people convicted in this mass trial. So a group of activists in Phoenix and in Tucson decided that they would stop the bus that brings the prisoners to the federal courthouse. And, I mean, I didn't know anything about it beforehand. Somebody called me, tipped me off to go down there that day. I saw the whole thing. It was, you know, the whole operation was done with military precision. They knew the routes that the two buses took, and they blocked the roadways. You know, a human chain. They, people just got in front of the buses, and, of course, the bus driver has to stop. And then they quickly, they had it all planned out, they chained themselves to the bus wheels so that they couldn't just arrest them and take them away easily. So it was just this amazing thing. They lay there on the ground for about 3 hours, changed these buses. And, you know, this is Arizona, and it was hot. They were out there in the sun. And the immigrants are all on the buses, you know, wondering what's going on. And, of course, they all got arrested. But It turned out they did stop the streamlined hearings for that one day because there wasn't time for the immigrants to meet with their attorneys, which would have been unlawful. So they were very happy that they succeeded in canceling the hearings for that day, and as it happened, all those people were just let go. They were just deported instead of being tried and sentenced to a jail. So they were really happy. And by the way, their last of their court hearings was just a week or two ago, and the judge sentenced them to time served. They had all spent a night in jail. I think there were about 13 of them, people who got arrested. So they all were very happy. They felt, you know, had really been worth it bringing attention to the streamlined hearings.
Yep. All right, Margaret Regan, thank you very much for joining us on the show today, and thanks a hell of a lot for a really great book.
Oh, thanks so much, Michael.
Okay.
Appreciate it.
Take care. Talk to you again soon. You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we've just been talking with Margaret Regan, the author of Detained and Deported, Stories of Immigrant Families Under Fire. And that brings us to the end of yet another show. I want to thank all of my guests today, Joey Johnson and Margaret Regan. I also want to thank my assistant producer, Henry Carson, my production assistant, Jeff Pryor, and my board op for today, Teddy Robinson. I also want to thank each and every one of you for tuning in. If you want to write to me, you can at mslate@themichaelslateshow.com. Once again, that's mslate@themichaelslateshow.com. And we're going to go out now with a song that I just really felt like playing in the wake of all this. It's from Willie Nelson. It's called Across the Borderline. Talk to you next week.
There's a place where I've been told every street is paved with gold, and it's just across the borderline. When it's time to take your turn, here's a lesson that you must learn. You could lose more than you'll ever find. When you reach the broken promised land, when every dream slips through, cause you paid the price to come so far, just to wind up where you are, and you're still just across the borderline.